2. The Magic Flight. If the hero in his triumph wins the blessing of the goddess or the god, and is then explicitly commissioned to return to the world with some elixir for the restoration of society, the final stage of his adventure is supported by all the powers of his supernatural patron. On the other hand, if the trophy has been attained against the opposition of its guardian, or if the hero's wish to return to the world has been resented by the gods or demons, then the last stage of the mythological round becomes a lively, often comical, pursuit. This flight may be complicated by marvels of magical obstruction and evasion. The Welsh tell, for instance, of a hero, Gwion Bach, who found himself in the land under waves. Specifically, he was at the bottom of Lake Bala, in Merionethshire, in the north of Wales. And there lived at the bottom of this lake an ancient giant, Tegid the Bald, together with his wife, Caridwen. The latter, in one of her aspects, was a patroness of grain and fertile crops, and in another, a goddess of poetry and letters. She was the owner of an immense kettle, and desired to prepare therein a brew of science and inspiration. With the aid of necromantic books, she contrived a black concoction, which she then set over a fire to brew for a year, at the end of which period 3 blessed drops should be obtained of the grace of inspiration. And she put our hero, Gwion Bach, to stir the cauldron, and a blind man named Morda to keep the fire kindled beneath it, and she charged them that they should not suffer it to cease boiling for the space of a year and a day. And she herself, according to the books of the astronomers and in planetary hours, gathered every day of all charm-bearing herbs. And one day, towards the end of the year, as Caridwen was culling plants and making incantations, it chanced that 3 drops of the charmed liquor flew out of the cauldron and fell upon the finger of Gwion Bach. And by reason of their great heat, he put his finger in his mouth, and the instant he put those marvel-working drops into his mouth, he foresaw everything that was to come, and perceived that his chief care must be to guard against the wiles of Caridwen, for vast was her skill. And in very great fear, he fled towards his own land. And the cauldron burst in two, because all the liquor within it, except the 3 charm-bearing drops, was poisonous, so that the horses of Gwythno Garanhir were poisoned by the water of the stream into which the liquor of the cauldron ran, and the confluence of that stream was called the Poison of the Horses of Gwythno from that time forth.
Thereupon came in Caridwen and saw all the toil of the whole year lost. And she seized a billet of wood and struck the blind Morda on the head until one of his eyes fell out upon his cheek. And he said, "Wrongfully hast thou disfigured me, for I am innocent. Thy loss was not because of me." "Thou speakest truth," said Caridwen. "It was Gwion Bach who robbed me." And she went forth after him, running. And he saw her, and changed himself into a hare and fled. But she changed herself into a greyhound and turned him. And he ran towards a river and became a fish. And she, in the form of an otter bitch, chased him under the water until he was fain to turn himself into a bird of the air. She, as a hawk, followed him and gave him no rest in the sky. And just as she was about to stoop upon him and he was in fear of death, he espied a heap of winnowed wheat on the floor of a barn, and he dropped among the wheat and turned himself into one of the grains. Then she transformed herself into a high-crested black hen and went to the wheat and scratched it with her feet and found him out and swallowed him. And as the story says, she bore him 9 months, and when she was delivered of him, She could not find it in her heart to kill him by reason of his beauty. So she wrapped him in a leathern bag and cast him into the sea to the mercy of God on the 29th day of April.
The tale of Gwianbach comes to us through Taliesin in the Mabinogion, a collection of Welsh romances translated by Lady Charlotte Guest in four volumes between 1838 and 1849. Taliesin, chief of the Bards of the West, may have been an actual historical personage of the 6th century AD, contemporary with the chieftain who became the King Arthur of later romance. The bard's legend and poems survive in a 13th century manuscript, the Book of Taliesin, which is one of the four ancient books of Wales. A Mabinog, Welsh, is a bard's apprentice. The term Mabinogi, juvenile instruction, denotes the traditional material, myths, legends, poems, etc., taught to a Mabinog, and which it was his duty to acquire by heart. Mabinogion, the plural of Mabinogi, was the name given by Guest to her translation of 11 romances from the ancient books. The bardic lore of Wales, like that of Scotland and Ireland, descends from a very old and abundant pagan Celtic fund of myth. This was transformed and revivified by the Christian missionaries and chroniclers, 5th century and following, who recorded the old stories and sought painstakingly to coordinate them with the Bible. During the 10th century, a brilliant period of romance production, centering primarily in Ireland, converted the inheritance into an important contemporary force. Celtic bards went out to the courts of Christian Europe. Celtic themes were rehearsed by the pagan Scandinavian skalds. A great part of our European fairy lore, as well as the foundation of the Arthurian tradition, traces back to this first great creative period of Occidental romance.
The flight is a favorite episode of the folk tale, where it is developed under many lively forms. The Buryat of Irkutsk, Siberia, for example, declare that Morgon Kara, their first shaman, was so competent that he could bring back souls from the dead. And so the Lord of the Dead complained to the High God of Heaven, and God decided to pose the shaman a test. He got possession of the soul of a certain man and slipped it into a bottle, covering the opening with the ball of his thumb. The man grew ill, and his relatives sent for Morgon Kara. The shaman looked everywhere for the missing soul. He searched the forest, the waters, the mountain gorges, the land of the dead, and at last mounted, sitting on his drum, to the world above, where again he was forced to search for a long time. Presently he observed that the High God of Heaven was keeping a bottle covered with the ball of his thumb, and, studying the circumstance, perceived that inside the bottle was the very soul he had come to find. The wily shaman changed himself into a wasp. He flew at God and gave him such a hot sting on the forehead that the thumb jerked from the opening and the captive got away. Then, the next thing God knew, there was this shaman, Morgon Kara, sitting on his drum again and going down to earth with the recovered soul. The flight in this case, however, was not entirely successful. Becoming terribly angry, God immediately diminished the power of the shaman forever by splitting his drum in two. And so that is why shaman drums, which originally, according to this story of the Buryat, were fitted with two heads of skin, from that day to this, have had only one. A popular variety of the magic flight is that in which objects are left behind to speak for the fugitive and thus delay pursuit. The New Zealand Maori tell of a fisherman who one day came home to find that his wife had swallowed their two sons. She was lying groaning on the floor. He asked her what the trouble was, and she declared that she was ill. He demanded to know where the two boys were, and she told him they had gone away. But he knew that she was lying. With his magic, he caused her to disgorge them. They came out alive and whole. Then that man was afraid of his wife, and he determined to escape from her as soon as he could, together with the boys. When the ogress went to fetch water, the man, by his magic, caused the water to decrease and retreat ahead of her, so that she had to go a considerable way. Then, by gestures, he instructed the huts, the clumps of trees growing near the village, the filth dump, and the temple on top of the hill, to answer for him when his wife should return and call. He made away with the boys to his canoe, and they hoisted sail. The woman came back and, not finding anyone about, began to call. First, the filth pit replied. She moved in that direction and called again. The houses answered, then the trees. One after another, the various objects in the neighborhood responded to her, and she ran, increasingly bewildered, in every direction. She became weak and began to pant and sob, and then, at last, realized what had been done to her. She hastened to the temple on the hilltop and peered out to sea, where the canoe was a mere speck on the horizon. Another well-known variety of the magic flight is one in which a number of delaying obstacles are tossed behind by the wildly fleeing hero.
A little brother and sister were playing by a spring, and as they did so, suddenly tumbled in. There was a water hag down there, and this water hag said, "Now I have you. Now you shall work your heads off for me." And she carried them away with her. She gave to the little girl a tangle of filthy flax to spin and made her fetch water in a bottomless tub. The boy had to chop a tree with a blunt axe, and all they ever had to eat were stone-hard lumps of dough. So at last the children became so impatient that they waited until one Sunday when the hag had gone to church and escaped. When church let out, the hag discovered that her birds had flown and so made after them with mighty bounds. But the children espied her from afar, and the little girl threw back a hairbrush, which immediately turned into a big brush mountain with thousands and thousands of bristles over which the hag found it very difficult to climb. Nevertheless, she finally appeared. As soon as the children saw her, the boy threw back a comb, which immediately turned into a big comb mountain with 1,000 times 1,000 spikes. But the hag knew how to catch hold of these, and at last she made her way through. Then the little girl threw back a mirror, and this turned into a mirror mountain, which was so smooth that the hag was unable to get over. Thought she, "I shall hurry back home and get my axe and chop the mirror mountain in two." But by the time she got back and demolished the glass, the children were long since far away, and the water hag had to trudge back again to her spring.
The powers of the abyss are not to be challenged lightly. In the Orient, a great point is made of the danger of undertaking the psychologically disturbing practices of yoga without competent supervision. The meditations of the postulant have to be adjusted to his progress so that the imagination may be defended at every step by devatas, envisioned adequate deities, until the moment comes for the prepared spirit to step alone beyond. As Dr. Jung has very wisely observed,
"The incomparably useful function of the dogmatic symbol is that it protects a person from a direct experience of God, as long as he does not mischievously expose himself. But if he leaves home and family, lives too long alone, and gazes too deeply into the dark mirror, then the awful event of the meeting may befall him. Yet even then, the traditional symbol, come to full flower through the centuries, may operate like a healing draught and divert the fatal incursion of the living Godhead into the hallowed spaces of the church."
The magic objects tossed behind by the panic-ridden hero, protective interpretations, principles, symbols, rationalizations, anything, delay and absorb the power of the started Hound of Heaven, permitting the adventurer to come back into his fold safe and with perhaps a boon. But the toll required is not always slight. One of the most shocking of the obstacle flights is that of the Greek hero Jason. He had set forth to win the Golden Fleece, putting to sea in the magnificent Argo with a great company of warriors. He had sailed in the direction of the Black Sea, and though delayed by many fabulous dangers, arrived at last, miles beyond the Bosporus, at the city and palace of King Aeetes. Behind the palace was the grove and tree of the dragon-guarded prize. Now the daughter of the king, Medea, conceived an overpowering passion for the illustrious foreign visitor, and when her father imposed an impossible task as the price of the Golden Fleece, compounded charms that enabled him to succeed. The task was to plow a certain field, employing bulls of flaming breath and brazen feet, then to sow the field with dragon's teeth, and slay the armed men who should immediately spring into being. But with his body and armor anointed with Medea's charm, Jason mastered the bulls, and when the army sprang from the dragon seed, he tossed a stone into their midst, which turned them face to face, and they slew each other to the man. The infatuated young woman conducted Jason to the yoke from which hung the fleece. The guarding dragon was distinguished by a crest, a three-forked tongue, and nastily hooked fangs. But with the juice of a certain herb, the couple put the formidable monster to sleep. Then Jason snatched the prize. Medea ran with him, and the Argo put to sea. But the king was soon in swift pursuit, and when Medea perceived that his sails were cutting down their lead, she persuaded Jason to kill Apsyrtos, her younger brother, whom she had carried off, and toss the pieces of the dismembered body into the sea. This forced King Aeetes, her father, to put about, rescue the fragments, and go ashore to give them decent burial. Meanwhile, the Argo ran with the wind and passed from his ken. In the Japanese Records of Ancient Matters appears another harrowing tale, but of very different import. That of the descent to the underworld of the primeval all-father Izanagi, to recover from the land of the yellow stream his deceased sister spouse Izanami. She met him at the door to the lower world, and he said to her, "Thine Augustness, my lovely younger sister, the lands that I and thou made are not yet finished making, so come back." She replied, "Lamentable indeed that thou camest not sooner. I have eaten of the food of the land of the yellow stream. Nevertheless, as I am overpowered by the honor of the entry here of thine Augustness, my lovely elder brother, I wish to return. Moreover, I will discuss the matter particularly with the deities of the yellow stream. Be careful. Do not look at me." She retired into the palace, but as she tarried there very long, he could not wait. He broke off one of the end teeth of the comb that was stuck in the august left bunch of his hair, and, lighting it as a little torch, he went in and looked. What he saw were maggots swarming, and Izanami rotting. Aghast at the sight, Izanagi fled back. Izanami said, "Thou hast put me to shame." Izanami sent the ugly female of the netherworld in pursuit. Izanagi, in full flight, took the black headdress from his head and cast it down. Instantly, it turned into grapes, and while his pursuer paused to eat them, he continued on his rapid way. But she resumed the pursuit and gained on him. He took and broke the multitudinous and close-toothed comb in the bright bunch of his hair and cast it down. Instantly, it turned into bamboo sprouts, and while she pulled them up and ate them, he fled. Then his younger sister sent in pursuit of him the 8 thunder deities with 1,500 warriors of the Yellow Stream. Drawing the 10-grasp saber that was augustly girded on him, he fled, brandishing this behind him. But the warriors still pursued. Reaching the frontier pass between the world of the living and the land of the Yellow Stream, he took 3 peaches that were growing there, waited, and when the army came against him, hurled them. The peaches from the world of the living smote the warriors of the land of the Yellow Stream, who turned and fled. Her augustness, Izanami, last of all, came out herself. So he drew up a rock which it would take 1,000 men to lift, and with it blocked up the pass. And with the rock between them, they stood opposite to one another and exchanged leave-takings. Izanami said, "My lovely elder brother, thine augustness, if thou dost behave like this, henceforth I shall cause to die every day 1,000 of thy people in thy realm." Izanagi answered, "My lovely younger sister, thine augustness, if thou dost so, then I will cause every day 1,500 women to give birth." Having moved a step beyond the creative sphere of All-Father Izanagi into the field of dissolution, Izanami had sought to protect her brother husband. When he had seen more than he could bear, he lost his innocence of death, but, with his august will to live, drew up as a mighty rock that protecting veil which we all have held, ever since, between our eyes and the grave. The Greek myth of Orpheus and Eurydice, and hundreds of analogous tales throughout the world, suggest, as does this ancient legend of the farthest east, that in spite of the failure recorded, a possibility exists of a return of the lover with his lost love from beyond the terrible threshold. It is always some little fault, some slight yet critical symptom of human frailty that makes impossible the open interrelationship between the worlds, so that one is tempted to believe, almost, that if the small marring accident could be avoided, all would be well. In the Polynesian versions of the romance, however, where the fleeing couple usually escape, and in the Greek satyr play of Alcestis, where we also have a happy return, the effect is not reassuring, but only superhuman. The myths of failure touch us with the tragedy of life, but those of success only with their own incredibility. And yet, if the monomyth is to fulfill its promise, not human failure or superhuman success, but human success is what we shall have to be shown. That is the problem of the crisis of the threshold of the return. We shall first consider it in the superhuman symbols and then seek the practical teaching for historic man.